Okay, thank you very much, Matt. Actually, some of the work I'm reporting predates my accession to Morgan Stanley, which began on January 1st of this year. And in fact, let me take 2 seconds of your time to address the issue of how Alex and I work. So basically, I had a far smaller unit called Commodity Market Modeling. Alex heads a larger organization called Commodity Strats or Strategists. And I have a dual reporting line to Global Market Modeling and to Alex in terms of commodities. So that's sort of the way we work. I want to thank Matt and Renee for the invitation. I welcome Q&A at any time, if that's okay with you, Matt. And Alvaro and Alex have already heard this talk, but I hope they'll still laugh at the appropriate moments, even if they've heard the jokes. The first time I actually started looking at one of these things, it turns out, if you look at this, and I know you'll have lots of time to read this, you're not supposed to take anything I say in terms of investment advice.
So here's what I'd like to talk about. I'd like to talk about the volatility skew in crude oil options, futures, options on crude oil futures, in which what I'm going to do is I'm going to do three things, as you can see. I'd like to calibrate to what I consider a theoretically rigorous model. Then I'd like to benchmark against an atheoretic framework. I'd like to test the model in terms of its mark-to-market and hedging effectiveness. And then, as you ladies and gentlemen well know, one of the things we find fascinating about financial markets is what they're telling us about the future. And so one of the things I'd like to do is sort of extract, or at least attempt to extract, what I call the informational content of the volatility skew. That is, what are markets telling us about the future when we look at the vol skew, and then summarize. So in terms of the literature, this is there's obviously been ample literature on the issue of modeling futures contracts, and Alvaro mentioned some of these in his presentation as well. There are a number of papers here of people in the audience whom I've not included, but the ones most relevant to my presentation here, I think, are some of the work that Eduardo has done with Jim Smith and Foley. Basically, the two-factor Swartz-Smith model, as you can see, the one that I have here, includes a mean reverting model and a non-mean reverting model. And that is what you see there. And Eduardo has extended that model to look at stochastic volatility in his three-factor framework. So if you're thinking about the relationship between these two well-known models to what I'm doing here, what these models do is they attempt to explain the entire cross-section of futures prices at the same time within one framework. I'm not quite that ambitious. What I'm doing is I'm taking each futures contract as its own factor, if you will, and then trying to calibrate a jump diffusion model to that. So in that sense, it's less encompassing, but it allows each futures price to speak to us on its own. The data that I'm using entails the two that you would expect, namely the futures contracts and the option prices. And what I should tell you, ladies and gentlemen, is that my calibration exercise is a little different from the one that was just presented by Alvaro. What I'm doing is each day I'm doing the recalibration from start. So in other words, instead of looking at more than one date at a time, I stand each day looking only at those prices. So you could criticize the fact that I'm not looking at all over different periods. But what I'm trying to do is, and that's the thrust of my objective here, is obviously to extract that day's information. So there's not at all a perspective of what happened yesterday, what will happen tomorrow. Each day we do the exercise from scratch to see what the model, what the parameters are telling us on that day. And the atheoretic framework that I have is a maturity-dependent quadratic and cubic fit. I should point out, Alex has pointed out to me that a quadratic function of the type I'm doing here is actually subject to arbitrage, but we will, at least for this discussion, waive that issue. So basically what I'm doing here is, as you can see, I look at the volatility skew. The vol skew, Renee, takes every day one obtains option prices. You can impose Black-Scholes even if you know Black-Scholes doesn't work,
That's how you get the vol skew from option prices on each day. So you get the vol skew for the different maturities, and as you can see, it's a trivial exercise to fit a polynomial, either a quadratic or a cubic fit to that. What you get essentially is each day you get this sequence of alpha, beta, gammas, and deltas, if you're doing the cubic, for each and every different maturity. And the estimation process is the trivial one that you see there. I've used Vega as a weighting one just to give more emphasis and more importance to the at-the-money than the ones away from the money. Presumably that represents also the more liquid part of the curve. And as you can see here, I'm using Vega extracted from the Black 1976 model. Okay, so, oh please, yeah. You know, so this is in my, let me answer those sequentially. I look out 1,600 days. So if you take the data that the NYMEX gives you seriously, that's how far out they go. And they have an incredible number of strikes. Now, presumably the Vega dampens the ones that are very far away at the money and in the money, but they do give you an incredible richness of price. And I've taken every single one of the prices that they have, subject to this little screening here. There's some obvious ones that just look very funky if they are very deep out of their money. So I've ignored those. But other than that, I've taken the prices that they have. I would say the way I was thinking about it is it correlates strongly to the liquidity. So the ones that add the money are trading much more frequently. And there are issues with stale prices, as you know, in every market, but especially in these markets where you're not, and at the end of the day, you have this committee of learned wise men and women at the end of who decide where the prices are at NYMEX. And so one wants to be careful about that.
Where are the prices, you know, when you see what are the options that are actually traded in these prices can use more than how you confuse the results?
Oh yes, no. This is the most liquid market in the world, Renee, in terms of commodity. So crude oil futures contracts is the most liquid market in the world. These are not spreads. These are options on futures contracts. These are the vanilla options that are traded on the NYMEX for delivery at, you know, the Cushing contract, the WTI. So, good question. These are, let me show you one example of a calibration exercise in this atheoretic framework. You can see here the, on July 17th of 08, Alex was telling you about the vol skew. This is the vol skew, obviously, for a short time to mature. So this is only 34 days. These tend to be the ones closest to expiration. You can see the actual implied vol is the black line here, and the quadratic fit is, as you can see there. Okay, so that's sort of an example of one day's quadratic fit for one date, for one time to maturity. This I found of interest in looking at the time pattern of the short-dated alpha and the long-dated alpha. So not to take too much of your time, but let me remind you, alpha is effectively the at-the-money implied volatility for the different maturities, right? And obviously we can sort of, we fit that each day. And what we can do is we can look at them over time. And as you can see, this is the longest one are the 1600 days. I was just responding to Glenn on that. The shorter one is the 34 days. And I've always thought that five of the most dangerous words in English language are this time it's different. And we tend to say that every time we have a crisis. And what you can see here is that as we enter the crisis period of 2008, it is quite true that the short-dated volatility shot up. But the long-dated vols, this is the Samuelson effect, the term structure volatility effect, right? The long-term vols stayed reasonably the same at the mid-20s percent level. So it's sort of interesting to see that the market was indeed assessing that there's something clearly going on, but the long-dated vols did not move perceptibly, as you can see, over this time period. Now, in terms of testing this atheoretic model, there were two types of things I wanted to look at. And they're effectively in equations 4 and 5. So one of the things I sought to do here was to determine whether there is a persistence in mispricing. And obviously, if you see a persistence in mispricing, the model isn't doing a good job, right? Because you would expect the market to revert back to some kind of equilibrium. So you can see that what I did in equation 4 is simply the correlations in the mispricing across time. Right? So you observe it on day T, the mispricing, the difference between the market price and the value. You observe it on T plus 1, you can obviously correlate them to see how persistent they are. You can run a regression of the type you see in 5. Does it revert back? So for example, you would expect B to be less than unity, for example, if you expect prices to converge towards fair value. So I'll report some of these regression results here at the end. Let me show you the correlations right away. And remember that a clustering of correlations across the plus one, that's actually evidence against the model, right? Because it's showing that the correlation mispricing today is very similar to what you're seeing yesterday. And so the model isn't able to pick up the kind of richness that presumably is in markets that would have you have any mispricing go away as the market updates and appreciates the fact that an option is slightly rich or slightly cheap. And so I actually take this up here as evidence against the ability of this atheoretic curve fitting to do a good job in understanding richness, cheapness in terms of the option prices that we observe. The hedging analysis, as I said, I'll do at the end, but the exercise here is a trivial one. We already think about this kind of thing all the time. If you have a market price that is rich, you would sell the option and buy the replicating portfolio, and conversely, and then what you simply want to do is test the performance of the tracking error. Do you indeed generate consistently or not arbitrage profits by doing this kind of hedging analysis? So this is the hedging analysis to demonstrate whether or not the model is able to discern value in rich and cheap options. The Merton model will be a nostalgic walk down memory lane, presumably, for all of us. This is Bob Merton's work back in 1976. The only thing that you need to think about here is that you need to set the dividend yield equal to the risk-free rate, since we're obviously looking at futures contracts. And you can see the parameters that we'll be looking at. So there's the intensity of the jump process, there's the average amplitude of the jump and its variance, and then there's the variance of the diffusion process. And what I'd like to do is, I'd like to talk a little bit about the econometric side, because what I've done is to establish some structure, to impose some structure on the parameters that I'm estimating. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the structure that I've imposed. First of all, the assumption is that in this oil market, if you have a jump, it's going to be pervasive in all futures contracts, right? So if there is a crisis in the Middle East or a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico, it's going to affect all futures contracts, but to a different extent. And it's that different extent that I'm imposing cross-sectionally, cross-maturities across these equations over here. So for example, the average jump amplitude, which is k bar t in Bob Merton's model, is subject to this negative exponentially declining structure across time. Okay, so the idea is what? The idea is that whatever crisis you have is going to be more important for shorter maturities than for longer maturities, right? In other words, b sub k in absolute value will be greater than a sub k because you're going to have a greater effect in the shorter maturities, okay, that's obvious, than in the longer ones. And then with respect to the variance and with respect to the diffusion volatility, I'm imposing that negative exponential decay on all of them. Some of the a sub k's for t to infinity here, some or all of them are allowed to be zero if you think that in infinite maturity, the jump goes away altogether. Yes, please, again. Absolutely. Right, that's true. So it's incorporated in the sense that this is a risk-neutral process that I'm estimating. So So whatever the physical measure is, yes. I'm entirely agnostic, actually, about the relationship, and it's an interesting issue to look at, but I'm entirely agnostic about the relationship between the risk neutral and the physical. But the point was. The parameter constraints, let me just take two or three more seconds of your time on this. B sub k must not be less than minus one, obviously, prices cannot go negative. And so we imposed that constraint explicitly, but actually that turned out to be an innocent one. You didn't have to. The prices or the parameter estimates didn't want to go there anyway. Notice the way we imposed B. And so basically the constraints B here over with respect to the average jump amplitude did not have to be positive. Okay, so we allowed at each point in time the average jump amplitude could be either positive or negative, but the absolute value of the jump at the t equals zero maturity had to be larger than the one at the t is equal to infinity. Okay, so it can asymptote from below or from above, but it converges towards zero or towards a sub k, technically. And so they can be negative, but they basically, the absolute value of a sub k has to be less than the absolute value of b sub k. With respect to the variance and the volatility, obviously they cannot be negative, so those were the constraints that were imposed over there. And so permit me to show you a time series of some of these estimates over here. This is the one that I found of greatest interest, and I'd like to take some time to describe this. So this is b sub k is the average jump amplitude for t is equal to zero maturity, okay, the instantaneous one, if you will. Now, what I'd like to assert definitively to you is that the initial values that we put in were not negative. We actually put in initial values that were positive. Nevertheless, you can see that the model clearly went negative here during an interesting period of time. This was the peak at which prices, you may actually recall, the 4th of July was the $147 in 2008. And so the market was clearly signaling that it was expecting some kind of, or at least anticipating, some kind of crash. And so this is the way I characterize it, is it is a transformation from the volatility skew into a quantitative measure that tells you something about the average jump amplitude. And you see some of the interesting times to which we've been. Notice that after the crash ended, and we stabilized in late 2008, and we began to increase, in 2009, the average jump amplitude went back to a very neutral type zero indicator. The diffusion volatility, there's nothing particularly surprising over here. As you enter the crisis period, this went up. The variance of the jump amplitude showed a little bit more erratic behavior. So there are challenges in estimating these kinds of things. Essentially, I should have mentioned there are as many as 9 parameters here you're trying to estimate, and that's very demanding of the model, and sometimes you simply have to impose some structure on the points that you want to estimate in order to get something that that looks reasonable. So there are challenges in these highly nonlinear 9 parameter models that we're looking at. This is our daily correlation. So again, correlations clustering up against plus one is a sign, is evidence against the model. There's less clustering here, but there's still a fair amount of clustering. So we have not yet, more work needs to be done, but you can see that we are still subject to the problems here, that richness-cheapness analysis is just not that easy to detect in the data. And so those are the correlations that that we looked at. The type of hedging analysis that we looked at for the Merton model combined both delta and vega hedging. And I realize you cannot perfectly hedge Bob Merton's model because there's an infinite number of prices to which the jump can go. But basically what we did was we solved the two-equation problem over here, where the hedges were one where you essentially eliminated the delta and you eliminated the vega by using an at-the-money option. So an imperfect solution, but that's essentially what we did. You can see that it's trivial to solve this two-system equation. We essentially get the exposure to the at-the-money through the beta condition, and then you adjust with respect to the hedge ratio to get to eliminate the delta. And so if I were to report to you on those results, you see those results over here. And so the first results have to do with the regression analysis. And remember, in the regression equation, what we want to see was essentially whether beta, not beta, whether B, which is the slope, is less than 1. And we divided here by different strike over futures contract categories. And so you can see here that in most but not all cases, B is indeed less than 1. In some cases, it's not. So we are getting some kind of mean reversion in the Merton model towards sort of fair value. You can see that being captured over here. A estimate is over here and is widely negative in some but not all cases. In terms of whether you should rush out to use this model to generate arbitrage profits, you might want to slow down and wait until lunch at least. This is what we found in terms of a comparison between the calibration that we did and the curve fitting, the atheoretic one. We were able to improve the percentage profitability, but the magnitude here is not all that substantial. The average profit that we did in the delta vega hedging versus the simple delta hedging of the atheoretic framework is considerably higher. Alas, that combines the results that you see over here, namely that when we lose a lot more than the curve fitting exercise. When we win more, but of course, presumably one is concerned about losses that such a procedure might entail. So that's basically it, Matt. What we did here basically was to look at the crude oil futures model. Crude oil futures options, we looked at it in two ways, the theoretic curve fitting, the quadratic or the cubic, and the application of Merton's jump diffusion across different maturities. In terms of performance, we think the Merton model outperforms the curve fitting one. Again, there's issues with the curve fitting one as being naive or subject to arbitrage. And as people who study financial markets, I think that the informative insights, the informative content of these markets, at least for my part, I find them quite interesting. Remember the caveat, this is the risk-neutral price expectation, not the physical measure, but nevertheless, I found the implications interesting. With that, Matt, I return it to you.